Welcome to the Legal Nurse Podcast, where you'll get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside the legal nurse consulting business. They'll share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with over 30 years' experience. So join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's your host, Pat Iyer.
Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, and this is Pat Iyer. And today I'm pleased to bring you Bonnie O'Hara, who is a nurse anesthetist. She has a long history of providing anesthesia in ORs as part of being in the military, and is currently working as a legal nurse consultant, building her business and coaching with me in LNC Academy. I wanted to bring Bonnie onto the show to talk about an issue that affects a lot of people, some of the risks associated with anesthesia. Bonnie, welcome to the show. I'm so pleased that you could be here with us today.
Thank you, Pat. I'm happy to be here.
I know that for our listeners who are legal nurse consultants and attorneys, we often see medical records that describe the ASA status of a patient, usually documented in the pre-op anesthesia evaluation, can be put on the anesthesia OR record as well. Tell us, what does that mean? What does ASA stand for?
ASA stands for American Society of Anesthesiologists. And what it is it's a grading system of physical status. There are 1 through 6 different levels. And it's a way to communicate among ourselves. It's a way to communicate with people outside that gives kind of a baseline of how sick a patient is. It also is a way to determine risk. Risk for a patient isn't based just on the ASA status. It's also what kind of surgery they're going to have, you know, how experienced is the surgeon, how experienced is the anesthesia provider. All those things taken together with the ASA status will determine the risk for the patient. It's also used by insurance companies. Some insurance companies will pay more for sicker patients. So the ASA status is something that they use to determine what they're going to pay.
And I know that there is a numerical rating. Can you go through what each of those numbers means?
Sure. ASA 1 is a normal, healthy patient. That's a really low-risk patient. ASA 2 is someone who has mild systemic diseases. And that would be someone who's a smoker, someone who's overweight but not really obese, someone with a stable blood pressure, you know, on antihypertensives but stable, or someone who's a well-controlled diabetic. ASA 3 is someone with severe systemic disease, and that would be someone who's a poorly controlled diabetic, has a BMI greater than 40, end-stage renal disease but on regular dialysis. ASA 4 is someone who has a severe systemic disease that's a constant threat to life. And that would be someone who has had an MI in the last 3 months, someone with a stroke or history of TIAs. Those would be ASA 4s. And an ASA 5 is actually someone who is very close to death and who is not expected to live if they don't have the surgery. And then ASA 6 is someone who's been declared brain dead and they are an organ donor. So we're just doing anesthesia to continue perfusion to the organ. And then as soon as they take the organ out, we turn the anesthesia off. And then and there's also the E category, and E stands for emergency. So for example, someone who's an ASA 3E would be someone with severe systemic disease going for an emergency surgery.
Okay. So it certainly sounds like this is a great way for the anesthesiologist to identify the risk level and the health level of that person with potentially then adjustments in the approach to anesthesia based on the amount of risk. Is that its purpose?
That's correct, it is. And it also helps us communicate with other people. For example, there are outpatient facilities that will only take ASA 1, 2, and 3 patients. So if we're communicating with the surgeon and explaining that this patient can't be seen at this outpatient facility because it's an ASA 4 patient, the surgeon understands what we're talking about. So it's also a way to communicate with other providers.
Does it have any impact on insurance at all?
It does, for some insurance companies. Some insurance companies will pay more for an ASA 3, for example, or will pay more if it's an emergency. They like to see the little E behind the ASA status.
I'd like to switch topics and think about something that is horrifying for patients and providers, and that is the concern that a patient could wake up in the middle of an operation. What is the medical term for that?
Well, it's awareness under anesthesia, and we shorten that to recall. So if you hear anesthesia people talking about recall, what we mean is awareness under anesthesia.
How common is that?
It's extremely rare. I don't think people understand how safe anesthesia is today. We are doing sicker and sicker patients because our drugs are safer and because our monitoring is so safe. But the overall incidence of awareness under anesthesia recall is 0.13%. It's very low.
All right. Are there certain people who are at higher risk for this rare event to occur?
There are. There's three general categories, and there's some general categories of types of surgeries, and then there are some other categories. The most common is would be probably trauma. And if you think about it, a trauma comes in, and if this, particularly if they're hemorrhaging, they have a very low blood pressure, fast heart rate. Every anesthetic drug that we give depresses the heart. There's one drug, ketamine, that depresses the heart, but it also stimulates the sympathetic system, producing more adrenaline, and that overcomes the heart depression. However, if the trauma has been out long enough that the heart rate's starting to slow down, their sympathetic system simply can't produce more adrenaline, then even the ketamine will depress the heart. So everything that we give, some depress the heart more, some depress the heart less. But if you have someone who has an extremely low blood pressure, it's a trauma, they're hypovolemic, we have to be very careful about how much drug we give them. And so it's possible in those cases to have recall. OB C-section is the same kind of thing. It's an emergency C-section. If they're bleeding, again, we can't give a lot of drug if they've got a really low blood pressure. If the mom is in trouble, which means that the baby's in trouble, or if the baby's in trouble, the emergency C-section happens very, very quickly. Basically, as soon as the surgeons are standing by, we push the drug, we intubate, we say cut, and they get that baby out. And it happens very, very quickly. As a result, it's possible for the drugs to not quite hit the brain quickly enough, and there may be some recall in that situation. It's not that anyone's done anything wrong. It's that we're trying to save mom and the baby, basically. And so we're making things happen very, very quickly. And the third category, cardiac surgery. And usually it's when they're coming off bypass and they're being rewarmed. First of all, we don't want to depress the heart, so we have to be very careful at that point. And also we're rewarming someone, and a warmer patient takes more anesthesia than a cold patient. So it's possible at that point to have recall. Those are kind of the surgical categories. Also, if someone's a difficult intubation, it's possible for the medication to wear off. We try to redose, but sometimes the timing can be off a little bit. Using neuromuscular blockers, which means that the patient can't move. Movement can be an indication that a patient is waking up. And if we have them paralyzed, they can't move. That's a very low number. Need to reassure people on that one. It's about 0.18%. And those with neuromuscular blockers who have recall are 0.1%. So there's not a huge, huge difference there, but it is a little bit more risky. And then anybody who has a previous history of recall is at a greater risk the next time as well.
Can you tell us what a nurse anesthetist might do to try to avoid that awareness under anesthesia?
Sometimes there's nothing at all we can do. If it's a trauma, all you can do is be careful and hope that it doesn't happen. Most of these situations, it's very difficult to prevent it. There is controversy about BIS monitoring, whether or not that works. We don't really have an answer yet. It's expensive. And do we want to use it in all cases when the incidence of recall is only 0.13%? So we don't know why some people have recall. Some people, we just don't know why they do. What we can do is if someone has a history of recall, then we may be able to take steps, give them more Versed, that kind of thing. But there's no guarantee even the second time that they won't have recall. It's a very difficult issue, and luckily it's a very rare issue.
What impact does giving Versed have on this issue?
Versed is an amnestic. It gives people amnesia, and there is a small amount of retrograde amnesia. For example, if you start an IV on a patient and give them Versed, a lot of times they don't remember the IV start. So it's an amnestic. It helps give people amnesia so that even if they did wake up, they may not remember it. Or if they did have awareness, is probably a better way to say it, then they may not remember it.
Have you ever had a patient say to you, "I remember part of what happened in the operating room"?
I've had two patients who did. One remembered her intubation, and the other one remembered her, had recall or awareness intraoperatively. And in the first one, all I could do was assure that I would, you know, just give her some additional drug, which is what I did. I gave her more than I would have ordinarily given, and she had no problems and she had no recall afterwards. So she's someone who probably just took more drug than we would have anticipated. The second one was a patient that was just very sensitive to anesthetic gases. And what you do normally is if blood pressure drops and the heart rate goes up, you back off on the anesthetic gas. Well, apparently with her, you back off, and that's when she would get awareness. So what I would do is periodically I gave her Versed during the case, and she had no problems afterwards. She didn't have any problems with recall at all. But I could see how an anesthesia provider doing what we would normally do would not expect to have any recall. I have backed off on anesthetic gases hundreds, probably thousands of times, and not had any recall. So she was just one of those people that are really sensitive, and there's no way to predict who those people are.
If an attorney came to you with a case involving a patient who said that she woke up during the middle of the operation and experienced excruciating pain, the attorney's question of you probably would be, does that mean that somebody did something wrong? How would you respond to that?
Well, two things. First of all, I think your point, somebody waking up with excruciating pain, patients that have recall that have no pain do much better than patients that have recall with pain. And in fact, if anyone's going to have any mental issues, it'll be the person who has a lot of pain. But if someone came to me and said, "Is this malpractice?" I think there are some things that you have to look at. First of all, was the anesthesia provider paying attention? Were they texting during the case? Were they reading during the case? Were they busy socializing during the case? Those are things that you'd have to find out. If the anesthesia provider was paying close attention, there are just some people, for reasons that we don't yet know, who get recall. just like that woman that I had, had she not told me that she had recall, then I wouldn't have known to give her some additional drugs. So sometimes there's no way to know until it happens.
As a legal nurse consultant, you play a crucial role in helping attorneys identify medical malpractice cases that are meritorious. There is a lot at stake in a medical malpractice case: the costs, the potential recovery for the plaintiff, and the reputations of the defendants. Using your medical knowledge and analytical skills, you are in a prime position to help attorneys understand the merits of a medical malpractice claim. You can be the light that guides the attorney to the meritorious claims. I have a 90-minute online training for you called Medical Malpractice LNC Case Screening. This program is ideal for legal nurse consultants and medical expert witnesses. In this 90-minute program, you will learn how to establish the standard of care, how to identify theories of liability, how to use key elements of effective case screening, how to spot case winners and losers, and how to avoid some pitfalls of medical record analysis. The presenters of this program are myself and Barbara Levin. Join us as we teach this program as an experienced legal nurse consultant and expert witnesses. Both of us have over 44 plus years reviewing cases as expert witnesses and consultants. We give you insider tips on the legal nurse consultant's role in the complex world of medical malpractice. We share our deep knowledge with you. You'll hear about our most memorable cases and what lessons you may learn from them. Get the critical details about screening a medical malpractice case by investing in a program specific to screening medical malpractice cases. Go to this link, http://lnc.tips/screening, and use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount on the program.
Let's switch our focus and think about something that is more common, and that is patients who aspirate during surgery. To put that in perspective, you said that anesthesia recall is 0.13%. What is the incidence of people who aspirate?
Aspiration is somewhere between 1 in 2,000 and 1 in 3,000. And of those who do aspirate, only 8% of those have significant morbidity, and of those, only 3% have mortality. So it's something that we all worry about, but it isn't something that has that frequently has catastrophic outcomes.
What helps to govern whether or not it's catastrophic or not? What kills the people who end up dying from aspiration?
Well, what people are, it's the overwhelming inflammation. The hydrochloric acid in the stomach is pretty vicious. And that they can either have a chemical pneumonitis, or they can have a bacterial pneumonitis from flora in the nose and mouth. And in either case, it's overwhelming inflammation of the lungs that makes it catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. When you think about people who have to have emergency surgery, I think about this risk of aspiration. A couple is out for dinner. They get into a significant car crash. The husband and the wife are brought into the ER. They've both got full stomachs. They both need emergency surgery. What does the surgical team do in that situation when a person has to have surgery and yet has a full stomach?
We do a couple things. We usually give them something, either Zantac or Reglan, which empties, either Reglan empties out the gastric system, or the Zantac
blocks gastric secretion, that doesn't necessarily help when it's really a huge full stomach. So we also do rapid sequence induction with cricoid pressure. And basically we put pressure on the trachea to try to occlude the esophagus. We give drugs very quickly and we get the endotracheal tube in as fast as we can. If they do have a passive regurgitation, we put their head down, usually turn them on their side and suction out their mouth. And then watch them very closely. But it definitely is a risk in any kind of emergency surgery where there isn't time. We don't have time to let the gastric system do its job.
And are there other similar types of risk factors other than a full stomach that might put a person in higher risk for this procedure or for this complication?
Yes, and actually there are certain diagnoses that we call full stomach. For example, someone who's pregnant, we treat them as a full stomach. Hiatal hernia, obesity, anybody with GERD, diabetes, they can have a gastroparesis that slows everything down. So those people we would all treat as full stomachs and we would do the same thing. We also might give them I didn't mention Bicitra or a clear antacid. We may also do that. So they would get the same thing. They'd get the Zantac or Reglan. They would get probably some Bicitra, and then they'd get the rapid sequence induction with the cricoid pressure.
And just to clarify for our listeners who are not familiar with the abbreviation GERD, what does that stand for?
Oh, that's gastroesophageal reflux disease.
Yes.
Basically, people that have frequent heartburn.
Yes, yes. Let's think about somebody who's coming in for elective surgery. We talked about the trauma case where there's an emergency surgery. I know that it's been drilled into nurses, NPO after midnight. Is that an absolute strict guideline that applies in every case?
It is not. We usually do that for surgery because, frankly, we don't always trust patients. Sometimes they misunderstand. Sometimes they don't hear us. Most patients can have clear liquids up to 2 hours before. Unfortunately, we tell the patient, you can have clear liquids. That's anything that you can see the bottom of the glass. So they'll have coffee and they'll say, oh, I'll just throw a little cream in. Well, that completely changes it. Now they've had a fat. So that changes it to an 8-hour requirement. But 2 hours for clear liquids. Healthy infants can do the 2 hours with clear liquids, 4 hours for breast milk, and usually 6 hours for infant formulas. And for a light meal, and that's toast without butter, without peanut butter, without jelly, and a clear liquid. And again, that can be very easily misinterpreted. That's 6 hours. And then just generally any fatty foods are 8 hours. But we usually just tell people nothing after midnight, and then we have a better chance. People don't always understand that aspiration, in spite of all of our precautions, can sometimes happen, and we'd rather be on the safe side. So in general, we tell people nothing after midnight.
I had an aspiration during a colonoscopy, and I definitely did not have anything to eat or drink after midnight. I woke up and I could only whisper. Mm-hmm. So I asked the nurse in the recovery room why I didn't have my voice. And she called in the anesthesiologist to talk to me. And he said, you aspirated during the procedure and we had to suction you and turn you on your side.
Well, and that's it. Even though you have nothing by mouth overnight, you still have gastric juices in your stomach. So it's still possible. Although in general, that doesn't happen very often. It's mm-hmm. pretty rare.
Yes. It certainly made an impression on me and made me not particularly excited about the next colonoscopy, which is not a fun experience to begin with for other reasons.
Right.
So now the aspiration has taken place. We're not talking about my situation. I got my voice back after a couple of days. What do you do as a clinician in terms of treating this? Is there anything that can be done to help improve that, the severity of the complication?
Really, the care is supportive. We usually, one of the things we watch for is what happens to their O2 sat. We usually put them on oxygen and do a chest x-ray if we're really concerned about them. We'll do an initial chest x-ray that usually doesn't show anything, and then wait 6 hours and take another chest x-ray. Most of the time, it's going to be in the right lower lobe. It's just an anatomical thing, but it can be anywhere in the lungs. And again, anywhere from oxygen, and sometimes, as probably happened in your case, you may not have even needed the oxygen. They probably took it off and you did just fine. Somebody else who might keep on oxygen, somebody else might actually have to go and be intubated and be on mechanical ventilation. But it's really mostly symptomatic. If it's bacterial, they'll give antibiotics. But in general, it's pretty much symptomatic. And then the issue, there's always the question about steroids, and that's pretty controversial. So again, it's mostly supportive. And for most people, oxygen observation, and that's all they need.
I have worked on several cases of people who aspirated on a medical surgical unit. Often it was followed by sudden death, and the questions always came up about whether there was any warning signs. Was the patient eating when she wasn't supposed to be eating? Had she been given a tray? What was done immediately afterwards to support the patient? The cases that I can think of, the patient was found dead after the aspiration took place. And it impressed me with how quickly a large volume of aspiration can end a person's life.
It can.
If an attorney was looking at an evaluation of a case involving aspiration, is there any guidance that you could give that attorney as a legal nurse consultant about that issue?
Well, the first question is, were there any pre-existing conditions that would increase the risk of aspiration? And that would be the first question. If indeed there were the proper steps taken, were the standards of care met, which means that they were given something to either empty their stomach or block the gastric juices, plus or minus on the Bisitra. Some people drink it and immediately throw up. And again, it's only useful within, I think it's an hour of the surgery. So, you know, it has to be given pretty close to the time that they go. It might be just 30 minutes. It doesn't last very long. And then did they do a rapid sequence induction with cricoid pressure? And that's always charted if somebody did that. So you'd expect to see RSI with CCP or rapid sequence checked off if they have a checklist. And then if they did have some kind of passive, if it was somebody who was not at risk or someone with risk who still, in spite of doing that, had some regurgitation, did they lower the head? Did they turn them on their side? Did they suction out their mouth? Because really those are all the things that you can do to try to prevent it. And if they did all of those things, then they met the standard.
Well, you certainly have given us a lot to think about this afternoon, Bonnie, in terms of the risks of anesthesia, the risks of awareness under anesthesia, and the risks of aspiration. How can people who are listening to you find out more about your services?
Well, they could come to my website, medanalysislnc.com, and they can always give me a call at 419-565-1022, or they can send me an email to Bonnie at medanalysislnc.com.
And just to clarify, in terms of you giving your phone number, what time zone are you in?
I'm in Eastern Standard Time.
Okay, so don't be calling Bonnie at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Please don't.
Thank you so much, Bonnie, for being on the show. I really appreciate your expertise that you've shared with our audience.
Well, thank you for having me.
And this has been Pat Iyer and Bonnie O'Hara, a registered nurse who is a nurse anesthetist, talking with you about the risks of anesthesia. Thank you, listener, for being part of this show. I hope that this has given you some useful information and would love it if you would come back next week when we have another interview geared towards the needs of people in the medical legal arena. Thanks for being a part of this program. Check out our online training and books at LegalNurseBusiness.com. Expand your LNC skills with our resources. Also, explore coaching with me at LNCAcademy.com to get more clients, make more money, and avoid expensive mistakes. And finally, join our continuing education program and get monthly trainings at LNCCEU.com. You'll get 2 online trainings each month designed to deepen your knowledge and skills. And look forward to having you tune into our programs again next week. Use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount on this product. You'll put that code LISTENED in the coupon code box during checkout.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on LegalNurseBusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at LNCAcademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes. We always are interested in your ideas for new topics. Please leave a comment on LegalNursePodcasts.com. Join our community and get notified of each new episode and receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on LegalNursePodcasts.com. We appreciate you and your interest.